Welcome to the EPA Alumni Association's Oral History Program's panel discussion with Bill Ruckelshaus, the first administrator of EPA, concerning the opening days of EPA in 1970. Bill discusses setting up the agency and taking on the first big environmental issues confronting the new agency. Chapter 1, entitled Beginning a New Agency, is 13 minutes long and begins right after the introduction. Chapter 2, entitled Setting Up the Structure of the New Agency, is 17 minutes long and begins at minute 14 and 14 seconds. Chapter 3, entitled DDT and the Clean Air Act of 1970, is 13 minutes and begins at minute 31 and 20 seconds. And Chapter 4 is entitled Leadership of the New Agency. It's 12 minutes long and begins at minute 44.
Hi, we're here this evening with Bill Ruckelshaus and three people that worked with him in those opening days of the agency, Phil Angel, Gary Bays, and myself, Chuck Elkins, and we're here to talk about those opening days, and maybe we might start with talking about what the world was like back then in terms of the environment and public interest. Bill, you might lead off on that.
I think it's important to remember that EPA was created in a period in our history when the concern for the environment and pollution was at a peak. Earth Day had occurred in April of 1970. The agency opened its doors on December 1st of that same year. And all of this was a reaction to what the public perceived as being a big public health problem associated with pollution in the air and the water. Drinking water, there was a lot of concern about smell, touch, and feel kind of pollution. You were sort of surrounded by it. You couldn't avoid it. And as a result of that, the president, under a law that then existed, allowing him to take agencies or pieces of agencies and put them into one agency under one umbrella called the Executive Reorganization Act, created EPA. You sent it to the Congress. If they didn't veto it within 60 days, his recommendation for reorganization, it became law. That's the way this agency was organized. That law has since lapsed. The president now can't do that, but in those days, that was in 1970, of course, he could. And EPA was created out of 15 separate agencies or pieces of agencies that were put under this one umbrella called the Environmental Protection Agency.
Bill, I remember back then that those statutes that we had operating as we opened the door were pretty weak in today's terms. I remember on the water side, we didn't have the authority to write effluent guidelines. We could require secondary treatment for industry, but it was very general. We didn't have jurisdiction over navigable waters. We just had jurisdiction over interstate. And on the Clean Air Act, the states were setting the standards based on criteria that the federal agencies promulgated. Now, of course, that changed on the Clean Air Act because as we opened the door, Congress passed the Clean Air Act in 1970, and that really, in fact, turned out to be a big job for the agency to implement that statute. But things were fairly weak by today's standards, I think, back then. We didn't have much to work with.
Yeah, they really were weak. The states were the primary regulators of industry, and the way they operated and whether pollution was going into the air or the water. Now, I was had experience in the state of Indiana in the decade of the 60s, and all of this responsibility was located in the State Board of Health. These issues were primarily seen as health-related issues, and the laws were very weak, and primarily because the states competed so strongly for industry to be located within their borders, they weren't particularly interested in regulating those industries out of the state. In fact, there were southern states in particular that would invite industries to come down to their state because they didn't have the same kind of laws that were being pursued in the Middle West, particularly the upper Middle West. And that all changed as a result of public demand that something be done about this smell, touch, and feel kind of pollution that was becoming more apparent all over the country.
Doug, do you remember anything about those opening days? What brings back to your mind about some of
you
the...
You mean Phil? Are you talking to Phil?
Phil, yes.
One of the things that you couldn't get away from was the sense of excitement at the agency. I mean, you couldn't walk through the doors both on 20th Street, but more precisely on 16th Street, or on K Street, 1626 K Street, which was the... headquarters of EPA until they moved over to Waterside Mall, was just that enormous sense of purpose and excitement that, in fact, there was this agency that was going to do something about a problem that clearly was on the minds of a lot of people in this country. The flood of resumes that came into the agency, the people who wanted to volunteer to work for the agency, it was a very heady time.
We had literally tens of thousands of applications for jobs that came into our personnel office in those first few months, of EPA's existence. That was a manifestation of what Phil's talking about, the great excitement that existed around the country about a new agency dealing with a big problem that people perceived and they wanted to be part of the solution.
Gary, you were chief of staff back then. What were some of the concerns you thought about how to position this agency in those opening days?
Well, I wish I would have been as thoughtful and had the wisdom to think about what the position of the agency was. Frankly, when we started on day one, it was on, I think, 23rd Street in the Chamber of Commerce or the
Chamber
of Commerce offices, or the Washington Business Council offices, and we had about three offices. And what I remember was, frankly, the chaos that surrounded the beginning days. We were there on 23rd Street for, I think, a month and a half or a few months at least before we moved over to 16th Street. And as Bill said, there was a palpable sense of excitement that we were about to do something big. And we had to do things big because the newspapers and news magazines were filled with stories about Lake Erie dying. And I know Bill from time to time talks about rivers were catching on fire. I think it was a year or two before that, the Cuyahoga had indeed caught on fire. I believe the Houston Ship Channel had the same issue. So we knew we were there to really deal with some substantial problems, and we were going to meet with immediate pushback. It was interesting, I recall, that the first company to come and see Bill was a friend, an acquaintance of mine, and the issue still exists to some extent to this day, and that is International Paper was being pushed by both New York and Vermont with regard to a discharge that they have, or they had and still have, on one of the lakes up in New York or Vermont.
Lake Champlain.
And that issue itself, which had been going on, and then not long after that, people started coming in because people were complaining about the iron industry dumping these millions of tons of something I had never heard of, taconite. Into it. And I just remember thinking, my God, what have we gotten ourselves into? Because he and I had come from the civil division of the Justice Department, and there were certainly major cases there, but I had never seen or heard of some of these issues that were so monumental. And the struggles I recall him having was, what are we going to do about this, because we really have no authority? And then that led to a strategy, as he was able to build his team with lawyers, and that took some time of getting the appropriate assistant administrators on board. This didn't happen immediately. I think he struggled for a period of time to get the right people in all these slots. And we had key support from individuals such as yourself who came over from OMB. And that helped us start, him, organize this agency to deal with these monumental problems that just seemed to flow into this office almost literally from day one.
Bill, I remember you talking, wasn't there a sense that sort of had established the bona fides of this agency, that in fact there was a strong sense in the private sector that this was a passing fad?
Well, there was. But today, it's not unlike today in some respects. Here we are in 2013, there's a lot of unhappiness with the government and its inability, apparently, to deal with some of our bigger problems, and they're thrashing around trying to do it. The Vietnam War was not over, and was disenchanting a lot of particularly young people in the country, but older people as well. And the government was not perceived as being very effective or even very efficient in doing its assigned task. So it seemed to me here was a big problem. The public had expressed deep concern about it. The government at the federal level had really not done very much about it up to this point. Most of what had been done, to the extent anything was done at the state level. So when the new agency was created, it seemed to me we had an imperative to show the public that the government was capable of responding to their legitimate concerns and doing so in a way that was very fair, but at the same time very aggressive in trying to address these problems. So we had to fortunately, we were faced with a lot of very big, and in some cases very arrogant polluters who were not only discharging bad stuff into the water and air, but were willing to confront the government about whether they ought to do anything about it. So it was almost an ideal situation from the standpoint of trying to start the agency off fast, show the country that we were serious about this problem, we were trying to respond to their interests, and to do so very aggressively. It's gotten to be a lot more complicated since, but at the time, it was a relatively straightforward problem with a handy villain out there who was confronting the government about discharging its responsibilities. And we needed to convince the public that if they said this was a problem and we didn't do anything about it, that was our problem. We became the problem. But if we were willing to do something about it, then the government was acting the way it was supposed to.
Well, I remember you going down to Atlanta, wasn't it?
Two weeks after the agency was
formed.
Tell us about that.
Some of the mayors lost their sense of humor during that period of time. Under the Clean Water Act, as it then existed, there was a matching program for the construction of sewage treatment plants. But the amount of money in the program covered just a very small percentage of the cities in the country. I think when we started, it was about a $75 to $100 million program. It ended up $7 billion by the time I left EPA, a little over 3 years later. But at this time, there was very little money. But the governments at the city level were waiting until the federal government put in their 90%, as it ended up, 75% from the federal government, 15% from the state, before they would do anything. There was nothing in the law letting them off the hook before the federal government put its share of the matching grant in. So at a meeting of the mayors in Atlanta, we issued an order against Cleveland, Detroit, and Atlanta that they clean up the pollution resulting from inadequately treated sewage coming out of their sewage treatment plants. And I announced it at a meeting of the mayors. There had been a friend of mine who was then the chairman of the mayor's name, Senator Lugar. Then I guess I can say now he's not still senator. He was then mayor of Indianapolis. He was a little agitated about the way I had chosen to make this announcement. But it had the desired effect in that it brought home to the country that we had a lot of pollution problems. It wasn't just industry, it was also cities, it was also sources of pollution that weren't necessarily what the public had in its mind with big smokestacks with smoke pouring out of it. And it was, I guess in retrospect, I'd have to say it was a little more aggressive than we needed to be. But by the same token, it sent a clear message that, again, that the government was serious about this. We weren't going to allow this situation to continue with pollution blackening the skies and poisoning the waters. We were going to do something about it.
Chapter 2, Setting Up the Structure of the New Agency.
I think another issue that I have had come up in a number of speeches I've made around the country is why 10 regions? And people tend to forget he had run for the United States Senate in 1968. And one of the platforms of his campaign was, not all knowledge resides on the banks of the Potomac. And I remember, in fact, there was an article in Harper's Magazine about the Roman proconsul system, which I think he read, or at least he referred it to me to read and others. And I've always traced that system that he said, let's have people closest to the problem try to deal with the problems. And my recollection is that folks were always complaining about they had to go to this city, to that city, other cities, to get decisions made by an agency. And that he decided, and I don't know how he came to this conclusion, but to set up these 10 regional offices was, I think, at that time, a fairly daring idea.
It was really an initiative of the president's. I mean, it was really President Nixon had the idea, stimulated by something Ehrlichman had recommended, that they consolidate the federal governmental regional offices into 10 separate offices. They were separate when we inherited the Clean Air Enforcement effort from HEW, water from the Interior Department. They had separate regions for water, for air, for solid waste, for drinking water. So putting them all together under one roof made a lot of sense. And the pro-council idea, the Roman council idea, was really, I think, Ehrlichman's idea from the White House. I mean, that's the way he expressed it to the president. The president bought it. So we followed it. We were a new agency, and we were able to make this adjustment pretty easily because we didn't have all these entrenched foot draggers going on that the other agencies have to try to keep that from happening. And a lot of the regional administrators told me at the time they didn't like going into meetings with the other federal agencies because they had nowhere near the power and authority that we had granted them at the region. They could act and act quickly and act responsive to the local problems. I tell you, when I came back 10 years later, that had all changed. We had much the same kind of bureaucratic responses that the other agencies were complaining about when EPA made its first foray into these regional offices.
Well, you put some pretty strong people into those regional offices, didn't you? I mean, we're talking about you handed over power to people who had the brains and the motivation and sort of the personality in many cases to essentially take the lead, perhaps sometimes faster than you were ready for them to. I don't know.
We had some real characters. Yeah, we had some pretty aggressive guys out there. Without them, when I say guys, I don't think we had any women.
That's the first time around.
We should have, but we didn't. But in any event, they were a mix of career people and some outsiders and some people who came from state operations similar to this. We had a very extensive review process that we carried on with the personnel office at the White House. And it's worth mentioning that personnel office there at the White House because it was then run by a man named Fred Malik. Who afterwards had several positions in the government, but he had come from McKinsey and Company into the White House personnel office, and it was 2 years into Nixon's first term. So most of the political pressure to appoint people who had been party loyalists into a lot of jobs had subsided. And we were able at EPA to pick the best people we could possibly find, and I had a lot of conversations with Fred Malik about it. I said, look, you've got a veto on we've got a veto, let's choose the best people we can possibly find. And he was more than eager to do that. And I think as a result, we were able to put really first-rate people into a lot of those jobs. I'm not saying they were all perfect, but like any personnel effort, you sometimes make mistakes. But we have some really good people. And I think that's carried the agency through its entire existence.
And I think Fred Malik does deserve some credit here on what Bill has said. I will never forget, Fred Malik comes to his office as Assistant Attorney General, Civil Division. And I think we both were a bit aghast that the man who had just thrown out and locked out one Wally Hickel, Secretary of Interior, was coming to see Mr. Ruckel's house. And I was so surprised that this very calm, and as he points out, McKenzie-type guy, and this happens when he's still Assistant Attorney General, lays out for these positions all these top-notch people and then ask him, do you have anyone you want to recommend? Because I went into the meeting remembering and thinking, this guy's going to come in and give my colleague his marching orders, and probably we're never going to EPA because I knew what his attitude would be. Mm-hmm. But Mr. Malik had a fearsome reputation at this point.
Yeah.
And he was the president's hatchet man. But he could not have been better, I think, than what he just described. The top people, and in the end, it was Bill's decision. And I think the president and Malik oftentimes do not get a lot of credit for that. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to imagine not having been there. But you know, this was an extraordinarily demanding time that in January, February, March, 1971, 1 month after the agency began. You not only had a huge public responsibility to establish the bona fides, to show the agency in fact meant business, but you had, Bill said, and that's something you ought to talk about, is how do you take about 6,000 employees from 15 different departments and agencies scattered in throughout the, you know, the 50 United States, essentially, and make them very quickly, you know, assume new positions and assume a new culture or help establish a new culture in a new agency that, in fact, was going to mean business and was going to be a permanent part of the executive branch of the government. And that was something that was also on your plate as well.
Well, it was necessary to do that. I had not had any experience of managing something of that size. I've managed in the Indiana Attorney General's office some 85 lawyers and 300 and some in the civil division. I was managed, I use the term loosely, I had sat over that many lawyers. That was nothing like the assignment of taking 6,000 people into a new structure and making sense of it. And so I had, fortunately, I had some really good help from people like yourself, Chuck, and Howard Messner, and others who understood that management structure in the government very well and very thoroughly. And so I was able to rely on their advice in terms of how to think about structuring an agency like that and keeping it going. And it was, there was a tension between letting it go too long so that people began to wonder what was really happening here, were we ever going to get ourselves organized, and moving too fast before you thought through what is the best structure for these people to operate under so as to maximize their potential. And there came a point where we simply had to move, and we made the best judgment we could at the time. Helped, I must say, with a lot of very good career people in the government, helping think through exactly how to do that. And Phil's other point about trying to establish a culture in the agency, it wasn't the only thing we did by any means, but one thing we did that really did work was we had a movie, or not a movie, but an interactive film process that was, we contracted with AT&T to do it. We took all the people in the agency and brought them to theaters, in many cases, around the country to listen to, unfortunately they had listened to me for a while, but they also listened to a lot of the assistant administrators and others as to what the agency was all about. And people were able to ask questions, and there was an interaction. This was brand new in those days. Nobody ever sort of tried this. And it built an esprit de corps around the agency in a sense of being all part of what we were doing in a way that was very effective. In fact, I was so convinced it was a great idea, I never wanted to repeat it. Other people would come in and say, why don't we do the thing we did 4 months ago and bring everybody together, get in the theaters, you can tell them what to do, and everybody else can say what should be done. I said, look, we were lucky that worked the first time, and it really did have that impact. So let's let well enough alone and not try to duplicate that.
But didn't you actually go out to each? You were physically there at the theater and going to each of the 10 regions, didn't you? Or?
Yeah, this was after we had that. I can't remember.
No, you started doing the regional. Going to the regions
immediately.
Yeah, I mean,
it was really important for them to see that this was one agency, to go out and talk to them. And it was just, to me, fascinating. And I hate to contrast this to something later in the agency. When I look back in 1983, the first time I went out, everybody was just so excited about being part of this new agency and doing something wonderful for the country. And they were saying, how are we going to stop all this pollution and make sure the health of the public is protected and the environment is protected? They were all excited about the new assignment. 10 years later, when I went back a second time, I went out to those same regions, and they were saying, hey, I'm getting close to retirement. I'm wondering about my pay as I go. There were all these kind of issues that people deal with after they've been in an institution for a decade or longer. And a lot of that initial enthusiasm and wonderment about what they were doing, and this new agency had kind of subsided.
Yeah, it was also interesting that the second time we went out there, you asked for a show of hands of how many people at that all-hands meeting had been there when he had done the first tour. And it was over 50%.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, you know, we went back to the 35th reunion several years ago now, but they asked the same question, and there are about 300 and some people that have been there for the whole time.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back, Chuck, to your role, and I think it may not be on the record unless Bill's done this at Harvard, and that is the enormous amount of work that had been done by a guy whose name is very famous and associated with this agency, Douglas Costell. And my recollection is Bill and I went over or were summoned over to OMB late summer, early fall, and there, you say you were there. I frankly apologize. I don't recall you being there, but I take your word for it. But I do know there were a number of young people, and they were working for something, I think maybe the Ash Commission or Ash Council. But I think we cannot give enough credit to those folks who have been at NASA. And I think Howard Messner and Seymour Greenstone that we just talked about and several others had been at NASA, and NASA was slowly shutting down at this point. But the amount of thought that had been given to organizing this agency, advising him, it was his decision, but I remember I had somewhat the unfortunate role of telling a number of people they were not going to have a role in this new administration. And Howard Messner and others at OMB, certainly for a young person such as me, laid the groundwork as his chief of staff of him not having to do it, but that team, and I don't know who all was on that team, deserves an enormous amount of credit, it seems to me, in setting up the decision points for him to decide to get the agency off to a much faster start than it would have otherwise.
Well, Doug Costell, who later, as you know, as we all know, became an administrator, he was, of course, in his younger days then, and he was the staff person who was running the Ash Council portion that worked on the EPA. And he...
But he also came from the Connecticut Environmental Department.
Right, so he knew...
I thought that was afterwards.
No, I think he had some background. I don't remember the details of it. But he recruited me over as his deputy, and we had Howard Messner and Seymour Greenstone, as you say, and we basically went through... all the aspects of who's coming, who's not coming, what programs are coming, which ones are not coming. Decide occupational health and safety would not come. I mean, who would think it today? But that was a serious conversation. Whether it's the agency should have laboratories or not. The ones I remember are Doug sitting around with all of us and saying, "Now we need to decide what the organization chart looks like for this agency." And that's when I would begin to tune out, because every organization chart to me looked the same as every other one. You know, well, you have a system administrator here, whatever. But Doug was very much into that, and we decided to have air and water put together because we decided that it was really important to have interaction between the air and water programs.
And weren't there huge debates, even with you, as to how to divide these slots?
Well, we had five.
Five slots.
Five assistant administrators approved by the Congress, all of whom, it seemed to me, had to have some responsibility for portions of the agency. And the agency's afterwards, there are now something like 13 assistant administrators there that have to be confirmed by the Senate. But at the time, therefore, we had to consolidate big pieces of it, put it under one of these presidential appointees. And how to do that, there's no magic formula for doing it. That's the sort of thing that I spent countless hours working with Howard and others who has had an understanding and responsibility that Chuck was involved in many of those discussions. And we finally decided on one structure, which has been changed several times since.
But it's still basically the same structure. It's just been added to.
Yeah, the danger was, and it's still a danger at the agency, is that you put these silos in place of here's water and here's air and here's solid waste and here's drinking water, and tell them all to pursue their own programmatic efforts without any connection with the other silo, and that you'll, instead of really cleaning up pollution, you simply move it from one media to another and declaring victory at each step along the way. To a certain extent, the agency still suffers from that kind of problem, not to the extent we did when we started, I think, but there certainly is a better, a bigger, a more of an awareness of the necessity of determining what should be done with the ecosystem, for instance, that involves air, water, and land, in order to keep it healthy and functioning for all of the various purposes it's to be used for. We didn't have that sense when we started.
But didn't you change that because you saw that very problem when you came back in 83? Because I remember it was Phil and Jim Barnes and some of us got together, and you decided as a policy you were going to move a lot of people from their slots to new slots, and that caused a fair amount of consternation in the agency.
Move people around, they don't like it. They like the way it was before.
But you made that as a positive decision.
Well, we did
turn it up.
That's right. We cross examined me.
Well, that's part of my little.
I don't want to call it whatever you want. Yes or no? Yes, it was. It was important to try to take some of the learnings that had accumulated in the agency up to that point that I learned earlier and apply them to the agency. But, you know, there were 13 presidential appointees when I came back. There were only five. Well, there were seven. You count the deputy and the administrator. So we doubled it, really, when I came back. And so they were already divided somewhat differently.
Chapter 3, DDT and the Clean Air Act of 1970.
I remember my thoughts early on was that we had a lot of work to start with the Clean Air Act just being passed, how to implement that. But then we ended up with this court decision on DDT that was actually the Agriculture Department didn't sue, but you ended up inheriting, or the agency inherited, the decision, which basically was no, the federal government needs to react to the petition to ban DDT. This is my memory of it, at least. And so here we are, we're saddled with yet another big controversial issue that took a lot of time and a lot of effort to make that decision. But in one sense, it did focus you, I think, on the pesticide program, which was a major program in the agency, which, shall we say, had been neglected somewhat at the Agriculture Department.
Well, we inherited one agency or part of an agency from the Agriculture Department, which was charged by law with promoting the use of pesticides, and we inherited another agency from the Department of ACW, which was charged by law with regulating the use of pesticides. As I recall, we put them all in one building.
And you had a portion from the Department of Interior, which was to look out for
fish and wildlife,
the birds. Right.
So you made them sit next to each other.
Whoever survived got a job. And DDT, there was a court order ordering us to look at the cancellation of, under the Federal Insecticide Fungicide Administrative Act, there's an elaborate process used. You can either suspend the use of a pesticide, which is immediate action, or you can cancel it, which triggers an administrative action. We chose the cancellation approach to take a look at it, see what the problems were. And after several months and an administrative hearing, which was held by, I don't want to get into the details of this too much because it's too complicated, but we had an administrative ruling that DDT should not be canceled, should be continued under the law. And then it was appealed to me as administrator to make a decision. The legal department of EPA represented the government's position in front of the administrator. I mean, it's a very weird law, to be honest with you. And then the petitioners, who wanted it to continue to be used, which were primarily the manufacturers of DDT, were on the other side. I decided that under the law, the risks outweighed the benefits. And it wasn't an easy decision. DDT had been a longer story, but DDT was a very useful pesticide in the Second World War to control all kinds of varmints that were bothering our soldiers. It was then used on a number of crops effectively. Its use had been restricted by the time it was finally canceled. It's a cotton, 70% of it was used on cotton. So we ended up canceling it, but permitting it to be used in emergency, and there were some emergencies since it, for which it has been used. But that, because of Rachel Carson's book, which sort of featured DDT as one of the issues associated with Silent Spring, it was an issue that got a considerable amount of public attention.
I guess another one that took a lot of your time was the automobile industry, coming out of the Clean Air Act. But the previous Clean Air Act had standards on automobiles, which I think the industry thought were pretty stringent. They were 85% reduction of some of the pollutants. But the Clean Air Act of 70 really put a much stronger...
Well, it put 90%.
90%.
What Senator Muskie was convinced of is that he gave the automobile companies, I suppose I spent 60% of my time in that first tour at EPA on the automobile industry. It was a big industry, very important to the country, and it was under a lot of pressure because of pollution being caused by the emissions from the tailpipe. And Senator Muskie had fashioned the earlier law, which didn't have anywhere near the teeth that the second Clean Air Act did, and essentially charged the automobile companies with making a good faith, concerted effort to develop less polluting engines in their manufacturing process. He believed that they had not lived up to that charge, and he was very angry about what he thought was the performance of the automobile industry. This all predated my coming to EPA, so I don't have any personal recollection of whether he's right or not, but I do know he was mad. And so the second law gave the automobile companies, passed in 1970 until 1975, to achieve a 90% reduction in nitrogen oxides, hydrocarbons, and carbon monoxide, and which was a very stringent deadline for them to meet because they have manufacturing processes and it's taken quite a while to change the engines to meet those kind of standards. And under the law, they had the ability to ask for a one-year extension. So we had extension hearings since 1972, which was an election year, in which it was the automobile companies were convinced they were going to give an extension because they could make the case that they couldn't meet the standards in the period of time that was allowed by Congress. After I sat in on the hearings because I was convinced if I didn't, I'd be accused of doing whatever the White House bidding was. We had no intention of doing that, but I just wanted to make sure that it was... If it's a bad decision, it's my bad decision. It isn't the White House's decision. So I sat through 3 weeks of hearings, and I became convinced after listening to what the automobile companies were saying and the people who opposed the one-year extension that they had not made the case that that one-year extension was warranted. I also was convinced that they had an extra year, which the statute actually granted them, to make the case, and if they made a good-faith effort in the coming year, they might be able to show that they needed an extension, which they subsequently did. So I denied the request for an extension in 1972. They came back in 73 and were able to make the case that they needed more time. Finally, the Senate and the Congress, not just the Senate, gave them until 1980 to meet the standards that had been established for them to meet in 75. And the result is, this is one of the things we really got to remember about the EPA. The result is that the pollution associated with the automobile in this country is greatly reduced from what it was when all this hullabaloo started. I mean, we've got 3 times the number of cars on the road that we did in 1970, and they're nowhere near the contributor to smog and pollution that they were then. It's because the EPA regulated, in effect, the way automobile companies were manufactured. The government had never done that before. I'm also convinced that if Senator Muskie could have become convinced that the automobile industry was making good faith effort and they were making a case for how much time they needed, they would have had this regulatory system that was put in place. But since he felt they were not acting in good faith, he insisted that the law be enforced against them.
And he had staff help, a very famous name to all of us at this time, was a fellow by the name of Leon Billings. And Billings reflected Senator Muskie's feelings many times to me of this just the line SOBs, and I recall distinctly, it was either during or after this time, Ed Cole, who was then head of General Motors, and I was very impressed to be setting up meetings for Ed Cole, the CEO of General Motors, to come see Mr. Ruckel's house, came in and in essence said, we can do it. But Lee Iacocca came in and his plaid suit, as I recall at the time, which stood out like a sore thumb, and sort of berated you and indicated they could not do it. Is that how I recall the story correctly?
Ed Cole did say he could do it and that they could meet the standard, but then I can't remember exactly the deadline you put. It was beyond 1975, certainly. I don't know that they went all the way to 1980. And Lee Iacocca was a much more flamboyant character. Ed Cole came in and said, I know you have to hold my feet to the fire, but my pants are on. That's one of the things he said to me. And he has pled for more time. He was no longer claiming that, you know, that I didn't have any authority to grant him any more time. Anyway, they had to go back to the Congress, which they did, and that's how they got it extended in 1980. But their approach was really quite different.
And the other industry that was under severe attack that came to me on a number of occasions that he had to deal with during this time was the steel industry. The steel industry was notorious for all this, now we call it particulate matter, then it was total suspended particulate, TSP. And we had, the six cities study that you had to wrestle with, but the steel industry also took an enormous amount of his time. And other industries, cement industries, that were putting out dust or particulate into the air. So it wasn't just the automobile industry he was wrestling with, or at least the people I set up to go see him. And I think this brings up another point, Phil, you and I have talked about before. And that is, and I've seen it appear differently with different administrators. His instructions to us was never sort of be like, and again, at this time, the two gentlemen around President Nixon were known as the Praetorian Dogs, I think.
Guards.
Praetorian, well, they're called dogs.
The Berlin Wall.
The Berlin Wall. I was always, while I was his chief of staff, and Jim Barnes succeeded me, and Phil, but he always wanted to hear as many viewpoints as he could. And I always tried to arrange that. And to this day, I can go back to this agency and say, doddering person like the three of us. You know, I remember one time I was invited into a meeting and I got to say this to the administrator. And I think by doing that, trying to incorporate all these views and not trying to isolate the decision maker, but trying to make him as available as possible to important people. And as he always said to me, make sure that you get some of these folks would never come up here because when I have these big meetings, I'm always looking for that one person down there that really knows what they're talking mm-hmm. about. And maybe after 15 or 20 minutes, you would say, that person will open up and say, have you thought about this? And that was sort of your style.
I tell you, the other thing about big meetings that I found was that...
And people complain about his big meetings, but that's what
you
want.
If you're worried about leaks, the bigger meeting you had, the fewer leaks you had. It's because somebody... wherever they were in the agency, felt they had something important to say about the decision. And they were excluded from the meeting. Then they just go out and tell some reporter or anybody else they can get a hold of what their point of view was. But if they're in the meeting and they had as big much of a chance as anybody else to be heard, even if you didn't decide a situation or an issue in their favor, they didn't leak it. And the kinds of decisions we were making, then it could have an enormous impact on the industry's bottom line. It could have an impact on their stock price. It could really devastate them if you weren't careful about the way you announced a decision, made it very clear what the impact was on the industry, and tried as much as you could not to have a devastating impact on some industry you were regulating for purposes of protecting public health. And so not having leaks was important because it could really devastate unfairly people who are being regulated.
Chapter 4, Leadership of the New Agency.
I'm going to come back again. I mean, this was an extraordinary time. I mean, there was just sort of... And one of the, I think, an interesting question is how you allocated your time and the resources that your time represented when the enormous amount of demands that were placed on you, not only to be a public figure, that was very important, and it was important for quite a while, not only to be a manager or a manager decision maker, because putting this agency together wasn't a very easy task, and the kinds of regulatory decisions that you had to make, the DDT decision, the automobile decision. You had to go to, you began to get involved in international activity. You had to go to Stockholm, you went to Mexico, you went to the UK. You had those, which were temporal demands of some consequence on you. And you were, and there was this enormous public demand to feed their demand for action because of what they thought that they had created in the EPA and wanted to see results as a result of what their what had transpired with the creation of the agency. I mean, it's an interesting question as to how you allocated that time.
Well, I think, again, when you started something like this, it started off slowly. But as I sat there trying to look at his schedule and manage that, Phil was involved, Jim Barnes, who unfortunately can't be with us this evening, Nancy Maloli, another young lady who lives up in Canada, was
Andrea
Paley-Logis. We would try to figure out, as Phil just said, he needs so much time to do this and so much time to do that. And here, I mean, it was not unusual for me to get over, and I've never, and I've told people this story, today it's not unusual in terms of emails, but getting over 100 to 150 phone calls a day. Mm-hmm. And so many of those came to me because they knew of our association going back to Indiana. Trying to organize all that, making sure that I met his demands that I want to see as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. Well, you couldn't see as many people as possible. And then these demands Phil was talking about, going off and traveling, going off and making speeches. It was, as I look back on it, frankly, I don't know how we did it at the time. And
we were younger.
We were a lot younger. But, and the fact is, and I hope you saw this at the time, you hear about all this backbiting and clawing among staff members, among high-level people in Washington, D.C., particularly at the White House. Either we were young, obviously we were, naive, which obviously we were, but we never had any of that that I am aware of the entire time he was there. And I think as the leader, he set that tone, but we got through it. And sometimes I look back and see these demands and wonder, how did we allocate enough time so that he could think through these major decisions and consult with the appropriate people and reach a decision?
Well, I think one of the things that strikes me is that it wasn't given that Bill had to make these decisions, and some other more institutional agencies or departments, these decisions would have just been done by people further down in the organization. And I think one of the things that really changed the way forever that the agency does business is that Bill started the tradition that these decisions, the big decisions, will be made by the administrator. He's not just a manager. He actually is a decision-making maker. And that they will be fact-based. So essentially, yes, the staff that came in to brief the administrator learned, you darn well better bring your facts with you, because that's what the meeting is about, and you're supposed to present the facts. And I mean, we take that for granted now, I think,
sure,
for EPA. But if you look at all the administrators of EPA, I think they have all, in varying degrees, but been the decision-maker. And I think in other agencies, I mean, you don't hear about the secretary of whatever making these big decisions the way we made them at EPA. And I think that's made the agency a lot stronger.
Well, part of it, of course, is included in statutes of Clean Air Act. Requires the
they can be delegated. But, yeah, so, no, you're right.
But it is, you know, you can set up processes for the decision to be made, but the administrator, like anybody at the top of an institution, even the President of the United States, all the easy ones get made before they get to you.
Right, right.
And I thought, particularly at the beginning, that you can't enmesh yourself in all the details of every one of these issues. You just don't have time to do it. So you better pick some, and we mentioned a couple here, the automobile decision, the DDT decision. You better pick two or three or four out and really try to understand what that problem is all about, or right down to the bottom of it, so that when you do make the decision, you can anticipate what's going to be visible, which decisions are going to be visible. And you better have the best facts you can possibly get and go all the way to the bottom of this factual and scientific basis so that you feel comfortable in the decision you've made. You recognize that because it's a hard decision, other people could make it differently. They could decide differently than you are. You're not all-knowing when it comes to one of these things. But if you yourself are comfortable that on balance you're making the right decision, that gets communicated to the public, gets communicated to others, who then begin to trust that the agency's at least trying to do the right thing. And that's the kind of problem that today we don't have that sense, particularly with the Congress, but with the in the case of regulatory agencies or even the executive office, that people are trying to do the right thing. I don't think you fail because you don't do the right thing. I think you fail because you don't try to do the right thing. And if people think what I found with the kind of decisions that EPA had, if somebody says, well, how did you make it this way? And you tell them all the factors that had to be weighed in making the decision, their reaction usually is, thank God I didn't have to make that decision.
And it's important to keep, again, another thing to keep in mind, this was an agency under an enormous amount of public scrutiny, and it had a big press corps. All the major papers had environmental reporters. Walter Cronkite had one or two environmental segments every week on the most watched news program in the country. There wasn't anything you didn't do at that agency, any decision, any trip, any speech that he made, any major kind of ruling that wasn't subject to an enormous amount of press coverage, which was feeding that public demand to see what this agency was doing.
And didn't Walter Cronkite come down to see you one time? Because I know Robert Redford called my office, and my staff was absolutely bowled over that Robert Redford was coming by to see the administrator. Eddie Albert, who was a very famous TV guy at that point, wanted to come in and do public service ads. Mm-hmm. People like that would call volunteering their service, and he had to deal with them. Low-lives like me could not do that. But it just gives you an idea of what Phil is saying. The visibility of this agency was...
But it's visibility, but it's also scrutiny.
You know, one of the things that I think we've got to remember about today, in contrast to those days, is if you look at a publication like EPA, Inside EPA, or that water publication, I forget what the nature of it, the name of it is, these decisions are so complex. And if you think you can, if Gary gets involved in them as a lawyer, I don't have to get involved. I have to read these 250-page rulemaking that EPA, I'm not going to read. But those, if you think you can just gloss over the surface and say whether they're right or wrong, you're crazy. You can't. So the general public, unlike something like automobiles or DDT, they just don't get it. They don't understand it. They can't. And it makes the job harder, I think, than it was when we started.
Well, it has been over 40 years since the time we're talking about, but I would like to think that many of the things that we talked about this evening, that Bill, you started, and all of us had a chance to try to help, really have made a difference. Many of them stuck. Strong regional offices, decision-making based on the facts, openness, transparency. I mean, there are a lot of things that you stood for and that you charted the agency on that I think have stuck with us, and I think we can be thankful for that.
Well, thank you, Chuck. I certainly wouldn't have been able to do any of this without you guys and a lot more people like yourselves who were there at the beginning and who were just as excited as I was. I can remember every morning when I got up, I was just eager to go down to work and get in the car and do it because it was really an exciting time. You can find a job, I've discovered in life, where you find you have challenge and interest and excitement and fulfillment all in one job. Well, you better hang on to it because you're not going to find that very often. And what the part of it I can find the challenge and interest and excitement in the private sector. I can't find the fulfillment in the private sector that I got out of the government because you're working on something bigger than yourself and you're trying to figure out what the public interest dictates, and it's very fulfilling to do that.
And I think we have to not forget the context in which we were operating. The Vietnam was ripping this country apart. We had, when he and I were at the Justice Department, riots. He and I would go to various cities on the weekends. That continued in 71, 72, 73. And this agency, I think, offered young people a beacon of hope that they didn't otherwise see in the future of this country at that time. Vietnam overlaid what we were doing in an enormous way.
And I think we still haven't quite separated out how important this agency was for Hope, that we actually still could do something good.
Yeah, I think there's really merit to that, having a government agency today, which is doing its job, which the public understands is doing its job, that it's accomplishing something for the public interest, that the money represented by their taxes is being devoted to something that's in their best interest. It's very important that any time an opportunity like that arises for a government agency that they see that as important for them to discharge, because there's enough things that the public won't understand and that they'll get mad about to cause their erosion of trust in government, which is a central problem to our country today.
And again, I think you helped create that trust because as we know this story develops, he and I are, well, he is pulled out to go to the FBI. You had this undercurrent of Watergate beginning to start in 72. He was trying to do some good things in 73, as we know, sort of ends his first career. But again, you had all this distrust, and yet EPA stood out, I think, as some sort of beacon.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill, thank you very much for this evening, and Phil Angel and Gary Days.
Chuck, thank you for inviting us and for hosting us for this discussion. It was really nice of you to do that.
It's good to get together.